My name is Heidi Michelson. The title of this session is The Bible Through the Eyes of Oppressed People. Okay, why did I decide to do this particular topic? Well, this comes out of my experience in El Salvador. A lot of times when we have worship, and in the parish that I serve, we do it base community style, which means that we have a discussion about the text. Instead of me preaching the whole thing, we read the text, and I might give an introduction about something, and then the people comment. The people talk about what strikes them. So it's really kind of like a Bible study. Well, as I did this, I've done this in El Salvador with various groups of people, I realized after a while that I was learning a lot of new things about the Bible. That the people were getting things out of the Bible that I had never gotten, that I had never seen. And I said, you know, why is that? Well, they're in a different context. Actually, Bishop Gomez of El Salvador will say that he learned a lot about the Bible during the 1980s when the church was going through heavy persecution. And he goes as far as to say that you can understand the Bible, certain parts of the Bible anyways, unless you're in that situation. That the Bible, parts of the Bible anyways, the apocalyptic writings or the New Testament, were written to persecuted people, were written to poor people, were written to marginalized people, and if you're not in that situation, you can't understand them. That's one thing. I'm helped by this in this whole study by a couple books that have been trying to bring some of the gems of Latin American biblical interpretation to the North American audience. Unexpected News, Reading the Bible with Third World Eyes by Robert McGaffey Brown, published by Westminster. And a four-volume set by Ernesto Cardenal, this is all in English, The Gospel in Solentaname. Ernesto Cardenal is a priest in Nicaragua. During the 70s, he served as a priest in a small island community in Lake Nicaragua. And what they did was they had worship services and sat around in a circle and talked about the text with the people, and he taped them. And they've been translated and put right here. So here we have access to what peasants in that kind of persecuted situation right before the Nicaraguan Revolution thought about the biblical text. And there's an awful lot of richness in there. So we're going to look at some of that today in about four or five texts, depending upon the time.
What was the first book, I'm sorry?
Unexpected News. Robert McGaffey Brown, Westminster. He draws a lot on these. And this is all the liturgical year. So when I'm preaching, it's just the Gospels. It's just the Gospels for the three-year lectionary. So when I'm preaching, I often look at this and say, what did the people in Solentiname say? Let's see if that gets me going at all. The first texts I want to look at are about Mary. And so the first text would be the Annunciation, Luke 1, 26 through 38. Luke 1. Okay. Somebody want to read that? Luke 1:26-38?
In the sixth month, the angel Gabriel was sent from God to a city of Galilee named Nazareth to a virgin betrothed to a man whose name was Joseph of the house of David, and the virgin's name was Mary. And he came to her and said, "Hail, O favored one, the Lord is with you." But she was greatly troubled at the saying and considered in her mind what sort of greeting this might be. And the angel said to her, "Do not be afraid, Mary, for you have found favor with God. And behold, you will conceive in your womb and bear a son, and you shall call his name Jesus. He will be great and will be called Son of the Most High, and the Lord God will give to him the throne of his father David, and he will reign over the house of Jacob forever, and of his kingdom there will be no end." How far am I supposed to read?
2:38.
And Mary said to the angel, "How shall this be, since I have no husband?" And the angel said to her, "The Holy Spirit will come upon you, and the power of the Most High will overshadow you. Therefore, the child to be born will be called Holy, the Son of God. And behold, your kinswoman Elizabeth, in her old age, has also conceived a son. And this is the sixth month with her who was called barren. For with God, nothing will be impossible." And Mary said, "Behold, I am the handmaid of the Lord. Let it be to me according to your word." And the angel departed from her.
Okay. I've studied this text with Salvadoran women. And we had a big discussion one time about Mary's attitude, about Mary herself. What are some of your ideas? What is the traditional view that you may have grown up about Mary's character? What was Mary like?
I used to think she was very young and passive.
Young and passive. Excellent. That's exactly what I heard too. And other things?
About sort of archetype of purity and innocence.
Archetype of purity, yeah. Mm-hmm. Good. That's very, very big in the Latin American church. Purity, virginity, you know, big thing.
You're also a woman of great faith.
What?
A woman of great faith.
A woman of great faith. Uh-huh. Yes. Okay. Yeah. Mary has been raised up in Latin American culture as well as this culture, especially in the Catholic Church, as the example of femininity, of purity, of passivity. But when I studied this text with Salvadoran women, and they looked at it again, and especially the text that comes after that, they said, "Well, you know, Mary doesn't just say yes right away. She does dispute with the angel a little bit. What does she say? How's this going to? I don't understand this. How's this going to happen to me? I haven't slept with anybody. So how am I going to get pregnant?" And they made a great deal of that to say, well, you know, she had a mind. She disputed a little bit. Now, you can put this. You can compare this text to a lot of other call narratives. What I mean by call narratives are parts where God calls prophets, Moses, Jeremiah, Isaiah, and in all of them, all of the call narratives, God comes to somebody and wants somebody to do something. And what usually happens? What's the second step after God says, "Moses, I want you to go and tell Pharaoh such and such"? What does Moses say?
He objects.
He argues.
Well, it says he can't do it.
Absolutely.
I'm not capable.
What if they don't? First Moses says, "What if they don't believe me? Who am I going to say sent me?" Oh, well, you know, say I am who I am. Wow, that's a lot of help. Well, you know, what if they don't believe me? And God said, "Well, I'll, you know, make you do all these miracles." And then Moses finally says, "Well, you know, I really can't speak." The women I was talking about, kind of talking with, put this into the same context and said, well, Mary's kind of objecting here, you know, in her own sense, saying, well, you know, I don't really get it. What's the point? What's going on here? And then in all the call narratives, God says, I'm going to do something. Don't worry, I'm going to take care of that. What is it for Moses?
I'll send your brother along,
and your brother along, Aaron, and I'll also give you these miraculous powers to make miracles and so forth. Jeremiah says, I'm too young, don't pick me. And God says, don't say to me you're too young, because I'll put my words in your mouth. So what is the Holy Spirit answer here? I'll come upon you, I'll put my spirit in you, and the child will be holy, all this. And then after she's sort of got her question answered, then she says, you know, Moses argues for a whole chapter. There is a difference. Mary doesn't argue that much. She just brings up a little point, and that's answered. And then she comes out with this openness. What does she say? I'm the handmaid of the Lord. Let what you have said be done to me. And the angel left her. Passivity. We put this text together with some other texts about Mary, and you're going to see that Mary was anything but passive. Now let's go on and do the Magnificat. Oh, let me tell you a story first. I was with a group of women in a poor community outside of San Salvador called Sacamil. And that was a community that went through a lot of persecution, and a lot of the young men and students, it's right next to the university, so a lot of the students were rounded up as communists and killed. And so their mothers formed a mothers group called comadres, co-mothers it means. And they would have marches to press the government with big signs on them with the pictures of their lost sons and daughters, and would say to the government, tell me where my son is, you know, give us our husbands back, that kind of thing. And Oscar Romero helped them form this group. And I was in this community in 1989 doing Bible study. And in their church, they had a statue of Mary on one side and a picture of Oscar Romero on the other side. And one of the, I was with a friend, a Salvadoran who'd studied in the United States, and he was very facetious or very kind of pushy. Most Salvadorans wouldn't have said that. And he looked at that and he said, who's more important to you, Mary or Romero? They had been talking about Romero. They had just been talking about how much Romero had helped them form their women's group to press for the bodies or information about their missing sons and daughters. And so he said, well, I see your altar up here. Who's more important, Romero or Mary?
Was this after he had been murdered?
Yeah, this is 9 years after he'd been murdered. And they said, well, you know, Romero's been very important to us. He's been, he's helped us walk in the way of Jesus. But, you know, Mary is very important too. In fact, in her song, she talks about the poor receiving, the hungry receiving bread, and the mighty being thrown down from their thrones. And they started to preach the Magnificat at me right there. And they said, you know, Mary's a great inspiration for us in our struggle. And I thought, wow, these women do not have a passive view of Mary. They have seen the real Mary. So let's read her song here, 46 through 55. Somebody want to do that?
And Mary said, my soul magnifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God my Savior. For he has regarded the low estate of his handmaiden. For behold, henceforth all generations will call me blessed. For he who is mighty has done great things for me, and holy is his name. And his mercy is on those who fear him from generation to generation. He has shown strength as his arm. He has scattered the proud in the imagination of their hearts. He has put down the mighty from their thrones and exalted those of low degree. He has filled the hungry with good things, and the rich he has sent empty away. He has helped his servant Israel in remembrance of his mercy, as he spoke to our fathers, to Abraham, and to his posterity forever.
Thank you. The Magnificat. It's one of my favorite pieces of music by Bach, by Vivaldi, by Palestrina. I love that music. And I don't think I ever listened to the words and what the words really mean until I went to El Salvador. And these women from this community told me what Mary said. We listen to the beautiful music and it sounds so lovely and kind of sanitized, and we can listen to it in big beautiful churches and not be changed. But what is Mary saying? What's she talking about? Tell me some of the... I mean, really, it seems to me that this song sounds so beautiful in most of the settings that I've listened to it, but really, it ought to be, it should have been maybe, it's so iconoclastic. It should have been composed by Stravinsky, or at least Beethoven, you know, some kind of really strong, you have scattered the proud from, you know. What's she saying? Tell me. Just some of these things. What's going to happen?
Comes the people's revolution.
Yeah. In fact, he has shown the power of his arm and has routed the proud of heart. He's pulled down princes from their thrones and exalted the lowly. The hungry is filled with good things. The rich sent away empty. A Nicaraguan Christian said the following about Mary. Where am I here? The priest, Ernesto Cardinal, said, I asked what they thought Herod would have said if he had known that a woman of the people had sung that God had pulled down the mighty and raised up the humble, filled the hungry with good things and left the rich with nothing. And a woman named Natalia laughed and said, he'd say she was crazy. And then another woman, Rosita, said, he'd say she was a communist. Mary should have been arrested for this song. If Herod had known what she was saying, you know, she was absolutely subversive. And what kind of, is it an individual thing or a structural thing? Is she talking about personal charity to hungry people, or more than that, or different than that?
To pull down the throne, that to me would imply a structure, because that was the form of government.
Structure, absolutely, absolutely.
But now where I struggle with a passage mm-hmm. like this is, I mean, certainly I can find examples, South Africa, Nicaragua during the 80s, at least in my opinion, of where that has happened. But I look at a lot of places around the world where that has not happened. So is God being unfaithful to this song in El Salvador, in Guatemala, in Rwanda, in Sudan?
Is this... an ideal or an expression of what's to come, what we're supposed to work for, you know, or maybe we're being unfaithful, yeah, right? That's a good question, and I don't know how to answer that.
Wasn't one of the major at least as I was a kid, the major misconceptions of the Bible and the gospel narratives was that, in fact, a lot of the disciples believed that Jesus was going to do these things for the Jewish people and Israel, mm-hmm. when in fact, a lot of Jesus' intent of his ministry and the reason why he was betrayed was that, in fact, he was talking about a heavenly, you know, the spiritual kingdom, and not a political sort of revolution. And I'm wondering how the Magnificat, as interpreted, plays into the misconception of the disciples later in the... Not that they necessarily had this up there, but I'm just thinking, this be interpreted both ways, I guess is what I'm asking.
I think that's one interpretation that's been used to get people off the hook for the political changes. As we'll see later on in Luke 4, Jesus is talking extremely politically. I would say that, like the disciples at Emmaus, Fred talked about that a couple days ago, are real disappointed because they thought Jesus would be the one to liberate them from the Romans and all that kind of stuff. And what Jesus says to them there is that, didn't you understand that the Messiah would have to suffer? You know, they sort of wanted a liberation, a political liberation, without any suffering involved. And Jesus kind of talked about the poor and about changing structures, but he didn't do it for them. Let me tell some stories. We'll get into that more when we get into Luke 4. So just save that. I just want to say a little more about Mary here and some of my experiences with Salvadoran women. I was studying these texts one time around Christmas. We did we have a women's theological circle with Salvadoran women, and we studied these texts, the Annunciation and the Magnificat. And one woman said, "Wow, I never realized how strong Mary was. You know, I bet, you know," and these are women who all have 3-4 kids, sometimes 2-5 kids, and they are very involved in motherhood. Just taking care of children is a big part of their lives. Many of their husbands were killed, so they're sole parenting. And she said, "You know, this gives me a lot of affirmation as a mother, because I bet if Jesus hadn't had such a radical mother, he wouldn't have turned out so cool." Now, you know, that was what she said. That's another Christology, to think of. It's more Mark's view of Christ that he sort of, it's Christology from below going up. He started out kind of human and went more and more divine or so forth. But that's what she said, and I that has always come back to me. If Jesus hadn't had such a radical mother, he wouldn't have turned out so cool. I mean, God knew what she was doing when God decided to put Mary as the mother, because Mary was obviously a very important, very interesting person. And then after this whole gathering, what we did was we were supposed to do something, some kind of creative thing about Mary, like a play or a picture or something. And my group decided to draw a picture. And what we did was, in Latin America, the Mary, there are all kinds of statues and virgins all over the place, and she's always standing on the moon and clothed with a crown and nice robes and everything, and kind of up there in the clouds. And a lot of the women said, "You know, we can't really relate to that Mary. She's just too perfect, too pure, too up in the clouds." And so my group drew this picture of Mary on a throne, and then about 10 or six women, which was the size of my group, with ropes pulling her down from the heavens. You know, and they said, we really need to look at a more human Mary. These are all mostly Catholic women that affirms us as human women. That's just not up there in the clouds, but she's one of us. And one of the texts that they looked to was also the wedding at Cana. Now, is Mary passive in that text from John 2 in the wedding at Cana? What does she do? They run out of wine. And what does Mary do?
She puts her son on the spot.
She puts her son on the spot. What does she say?
Well, she tells the servants or whomever.
She says first to Jesus, they run out of wine, you know, son. And he says, oh, come on, you know, it's not my time. Don't bug me now. Don't nag me now, Mom. And then she says to the servants, just do whatever he says. just fill up the, you know. And then they fill up the jars, and he makes wine. That's where the Catholic Church gets a lot of its Mary as intercessor stuff. But is that our traditional picture of a passive, you know, all suffering, all, you know, Mary? No, extremely active.
Does this view of Mary have anything to do with the fact that Jewish society was a highly patriarchal society, and this, you know, helped women boost their self-esteem? Or viewing Mary as having some power, even though she didn't have any political power or ownership rights or anything like that, that maybe looking at to her as, you know, empowering her as a mother of God, that she then had, you know, gave them the feeling that they had some power because they also were in a submissive environment.
Yeah. And later on, I think the church really worked hard to domesticate Mary.
But the Catholic Church is still like that. I mean, the fact that a woman can't be a priest and that sort of thing.
Yeah. Let's move to the Christmas story. Fred Niedner said the other day, there aren't any throwaway lines. Nothing is coincidental. Well, in the particular passage that he was talking about. And Latin American Christians will look at the Bible and find a lot of affirmation in the Christmas story. Why do you think that might be?
Poor birth or lowly dwellings.
Exactly.
Well, some of it's probably still a bit of their reality, just as far as the physical surroundings.
Exactly.
You know, you don't necessarily have the help.
Right. In fact, when we did our Christmas play, I was, you know, kind of excited. It looked so real, you know, to me. I just have to laugh that we made a little manger out of old wood and twigs and stuff. And I thought, boy, that probably looks like exactly how it was for Jesus. Well, I this is a couple days before the Christmas play, and while I was gone, you know, the people still have that need or desire to make things it's so funny. Here, where we have everything, we often, sometimes, you know, want to do these live Christmas programs and make them look real humble and real down to earth as it probably was. There, in Latin America, where we were doing it probably much as Jesus was born, while I was gone, they decorated the manger. And they put pretty colored paper on it. And then we had little staffs for the shepherds, and they decorated those up too. And I thought, well, now this isn't this interesting? We want to make our Christmas look more humble, and they want to honor Jesus as the King of Kings and make him look pretty. That was kind of interesting. But at the same time, none of the circumstances of Jesus' birth, none of that is that symbolism is lost on Salvadorans. He was born in a stable. He wasn't born in his own house. He was homeless. His parents had to wander around looking for lodging. What's the common Mexican tradition for Christmas? Any of you know? No. Las Posadas. What is Las Posadas?
They go around through the town looking for a place to stay.
Right. It's a celebration 8 days or 9 days, I don't know, before Christmas, enacted every single day, in which Mary and Joseph wander around the town, stopping at a different home each night or whatever, looking for lodging.
There's a street downtown Los Angeles that's very Mexican. And
they do that, yeah.
Is that exclusively Mexican? I learned it was Nicaraguan.
Well, it's mostly Mexican. They do it in Central America sometimes, too. Not quite as big. But, yeah, they could do it. And we did it this year in my community. They weren't really used to doing it. But I don't think it's any coincidence that this custom, Las Posadas, grew up in a very poor culture. So every Christmas, the culture is reminded of homelessness, of people wandering around looking for housing at Christmas.
I suppose our tradition of singing Christmas carols in different places comes from that same tradition?
Yeah. Could be. That we've lost the sense of homelessness, yeah. I think. Yeah, could. Yeah. Well, yeah, because there's a traditional song that you always sing, that the Mexicans sing in each, and there's a different verse for each house and so forth. Yeah. Could be. Who knows? Maybe that was a tradition in Spain that went into other parts of Europe. I don't know.
Well, if it wasn't a tradition, then we could bring it back in.
Uh-huh. There we go. Maybe we could bring that gift as a Latin American church to our communities. In fact, it was done this year in California around the border in San Isidro this Christmas, which was just after Proposition 187 was passed in November. Is that right? It was passed. Now think of Las Posadas in the context of Proposition 187, which denies education and medical benefits to immigrants and makes the medical establishment and educators little immigration officers. They have to turn in people.
Illegal
immigrants. Yeah. So this Las Posadas ceremony was done along the border in that context. Then the Magi. Now, in our Christmas play in El Salvador, as I said the other night, when the Magi came to our Mary and Joseph in the stable, Mary and Joseph were afraid because these were three rich people coming, and they wondered what these three rich people wanted of them. And I thought, God, I never thought of that. Mary Joseph might be afraid of the Magi. And then these three rich people end up bowing, prostrating themselves before a little baby. And I thought, wow. In the context of El Salvador, that's just absolutely revolutionary. That would never happen. You wouldn't have the president who would come and, you know. That's striking. And then what happens in Matthew 2? Fred's been talking about this a lot in the Bible studies with Rachel. Let's go to Matthew 2. Two, 13 through 18. Somebody else want to read that?
Now when they departed, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream and said, "Rise, take the child and his mother, and flee to Egypt, and remain there till I tell you, for Herod is about to search for the child to destroy him. And he rose and took the child and his mother by night and departed to Egypt, and remained there until the death of Herod. This was to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet, out of Egypt have I called my son.
Go ahead.
Oh. Then Herod, when he saw that he had been tricked by the wise men, was in a furious rage, and he sent and killed all the male children in Bethlehem and in all the region who were 2 years old or under, according to the time which he had ascertained from the wise men. Then was fulfilled what was spoken by the prophet Jeremiah. A voice was heard in Ramah, wailing in loud lamentation, Rachel weeping for her children. She refused to be consoled because they were no more.
Okay. This, of course, Matthew is partly showing that Jesus is the new Israel, that he went down to Egypt just as the Israelites and came back up. In those days, Egypt was apparently the prosperous country that you went to when you needed to get out of wherever you were. The Salvadoran Lutheran Church, as I said another time, celebrate this day, this event, in our church calendar is celebrated on December 27th, Holy Innocents, in commemoration of all those babies who were killed in stead of Jesus. The Salvadoran Lutheran Church celebrates that day as Day of the Refugee, because that's the day that Jesus had to get out of his country because of political persecution and go down to a more prosperous country, Egypt, to get away, to escape from being killed. So they talk on December 27th, Holy Innocents, about refugees and political exiles and so forth. Now, you know, none of this stuff is lost on Salvadorans. Another thing that struck me is I wonder how the Egyptian Lutheran Church celebrates Holy Innocents. It might be a source of pride to Egyptian Lutherans, Egyptian Christians, that their country gave refuge to Jesus. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I spent 3.5 years in Egypt.
Uh-huh.
Some of that time working with the Coptic Orthodox Church. There is of course, there is a Catholic and there is a Protestant church, mm-hmm. As well as the Coptic Orthodox. But the Orthodox is the traditional one that mm-hmm. kind of arose. And their celebration of their of the hospitality the exact route that we're and the places of refuge in Egypt that the Holy Family had in Egypt is a well-developed tradition, and Annette and I worshipped in one of their churches on the south mile south of Cairo, where the Holy Family was supposed to have stayed for several times, and they have non-biblical sources where they said the whole Holy Family was here, and then the other night it was here, and they have other miracles. In fact, that were supposedly done by the child Jesus during his childhood at various places in Egypt while they were there.
So it's a rich
thing in the Coptic Orthodox Church.
How do you think African American churches might feel about this text? Might celebrate this text? Might be, another important thing for them to see themselves in the Bible. Oh, here we are. We get in there too. Yeah. So I ask myself, all the time, is it coincidence that God chose to be born, that the Christmas story is written like this? it would have been just as easy to write it for God to have Jesus born, you know, in a middle-class home at least, or, you know, kind of nice or something. Just saying something, you know.
Well, he would have had more standing if he would have come out of the university.
Yeah.
He would have been the esteemed lecturer from Harvard.
Right.
Traveled the country.
Exactly.
I mean, that's esteemed in certain areas. The eggheads don't have esteem everywhere.
Okay, we're gonna go fast here. I gotta do this one because it's what the Nicaraguans got out of this next text is different than what we get, what I've gotten in the past. Matthew 25:31-46.
35?
Matthew 25:31-46. We're not going to read it. Just you've all heard this text a million times. Comes up several times in the lectionary. The sheep and the goats. One side gets condemned. Why do they get condemned? When I was hungry, when I was thirsty, you didn't give me anything to eat. When I was in prison, you didn't. You know. And the goats and the sheep get blessed into everlasting, and they say, well, why? You know, when did we see you? First they ask why, and Jesus said, I was hungry and you gave me food, I was sick and in prison and you came to visit me, I needed water and you needed clothes and you gave me clothes, and they said, well, when did we ever see you? And Jesus says, when you did it to the least of these, you did it for me. So, what did the last sermon that you heard about this text say about it?
That we should take care of our neighbors.
Uh-huh. Yep. We should take care of our neighbors. Okay. Yep.
It's kind of like what Mother Teresa says a lot, that uh-huh. you see Christ in the faces of the dying and the orphans.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I looked at this text and I thought that what the Nicaraguan Christians would get out of it would be the same thing. And they got something different out of it. Very interesting. Look at the beginning of the text. When the Son of Man comes in His glory by all the angels, then He will take His seat on His throne of glory. All the nations will be assembled before Him, and He will separate them one from another as the shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. One of the worshipers in Solentanami, Nicaragua, says this. Alejandro, a worshiper in Solentanami, worries that the things Christ names here will be understood as simple traditional charity. And I don't think that's the meaning. Although traditional charity may sometimes be all that is possible, Christians need to start thinking about collectivized charity, a whole system where justice no longer exists. What Gustavo Gutierrez says is that it's real notable that Jesus says He's judging, it says the Son of Man is judging the nations. The nations, collectively. And separating the nations. Okay, there's one nation that goes on this side and another nation goes on that side.
But there were no nations as we think of them back then.
Okay, well, tribes, the peoples, the peoples. But what the Nicaraguans say is that that this text is talking about judging the nations. That it's a corporate kind of accountability. And so you have to ask, does our nation feed the hungry? Does our nation welcome strangers? Does our nation visit the sick? Is that in there or not? Is that a valid interpretation? Or, you know, it's so different than what I've always heard that really kind of jars me. Could that be part of it?
It's usually not. I certainly don't remember growing up in Sunday school talking about what is my country doing in regards to this. It was more you, Mark, as a good little Christian eighth grader. You know, what are you doing?
Right. Right. And then about who's the judger, who gets to judge? Nicaraguan Christians say this. One guy says, the tortured ones, the starving, the ones from the wretched districts like Ajaguacalincha, obviously a place they knew of, they're the ones who can best understand injustices. The ones who are suffering them, who are God. That's very simple, isn't it? And then Julio says, that means that here it's up to the exploited ones to put themselves in God's place, who they really are, and say to the rich, I was thirsty and you didn't give me water. And so the exploited ones will have to say those words. So they're saying that the people who are suffering are the ones who can be the Son of Man and say that to nations.
I was over in Ecuador for the first indigenous meeting of America, of the Indian peoples of North, South, and Central America. And part of their struggle for more Central American, South American people was in the thinking of nations was the trouble with understanding how, as the people of the United States are really being their troubles in their countries and trying to understand why can they do that to us, or why can they do this to us.
Furthermore, Ernesto, the priest in this community, then asked. Now, this I'm going to get in hot water for this, so I'm just going to say what the Nicaraguans said. They said, "So, if this is judging the nations, what nations are the sheep, and what nations are the goats?" And the Nicaraguans said, in Cuba, everybody's been fed and given clothing, adequate housing, medical care, and education. I think that when Christ spoke of these things, which are a person's basic necessities and the first one that have to be considered, he was thinking more than a traditional charity, of revolutionary charity. That's effective charity. So they pointed out to Cuba and said, that's the sheep nation. And I have a little personal experience with that because I have a friend who's a Salvadoran who grew up in Cuba, and his parents went there in like 1980. And now he's back in El Salvador, and he got a much better education. The friends who are at the same age level as he, who stayed in El Salvador, never got to finish high school. And he's in college right now because he got all free education. So now we can talk about other things in Cuba, you know, political freedom and so forth. But as far as clothing the naked and medical care and all that, they've been doing it. And they're looked up to all of Latin America as they helped thousands of Salvadoran and Nicaraguans went to Cuba and got medical care and education and sent their kids to Cuba so they could be in the war and all that kind of stuff.
I've seen the same thing said about at least the ideal, the hope of the Sandinista regime in Nicaragua, that they were at least initially, I don't know how it developed, but initially concerned with education, public health, those sorts of people-centered structures within the country.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, time fleets fast.
I was going to just mention one other example is China has pretty much at least years past eliminated hunger. Here's a very poor populous country, but yet was able to manage to feed folks. And obviously there are other things going on there. But again, there's a...
Okay. Now we're gonna get into even more hot water. Now we're gonna do go to Matthew 19. Matthew 19. Matthew 19, 10 through 12. Jesus has just been talking about divorce and marriage and so forth. And then he says this. Somebody want to read that? Just 10 through 12.
Disciples said to him, if this is the situation between a husband and a wife, it is better not to marry. Jesus replied, not everyone can accept this word, but those to whom it has been given. For some are eunuchs because they were born that way. Others were made that way by men. And others have renounced marriage because of the kingdom of heaven. The one who can accept this should accept it.
I've been reading a book called Holy Homosexuals by the pastor of the largest metropolitan community church in the country and the world in Dallas. And he reads this text. How would you read this text if you were gay or lesbian? How might you read this text?
But you're born that way.
Uh-huh. If you were born that. This is the only place where I have been able to find that Jesus has anything to say that might remotely... that Jesus says anything that might remotely relate to homosexuality.
Can you give me a definition of eunuch? Because I'm wondering if I have...
Yeah. This guy says that it was a practice in the courts for eunuchs, for men to be castrated so that they could serve the queen and not be sexually... active with the queen or with the high officials or so forth. That was a practice for a while. But it seems to me that it would have been likely that the word eunuch then would sort of be generalized to mean anybody who didn't get married and didn't have kids or couldn't have children for whatever reason. Or people who had some kind of physical problem, and that that this very well could have referred to somebody who didn't have a sexual drive towards the opposite sex.
So do the South Salvadorans have something to say about
that? No, this is, I said, from the eyes of oppressed people.
Oh.
Actually, the Nicaraguans did. They looked at this text, and there was a gay person in the community, and he said, this refers to me. This is where I find myself in the Bible. This is a Nicaraguan person. That's actually where I first found the text, and then I saw it in here again. Well, now I want to give you another situation here. I have a friend who is a member of four mutually exclusive categories of people. He's African American, Lutheran, gay, military chaplain. Now listen to this. The military doesn't deal with his being gay. The Lutheran Church doesn't always understand him because he's black. The black church, he's also from a Pentecostal fundamentalist background. The black church doesn't accept him as a Lutheran or as gay. They're extremely against him for that. What did I say? Lutheran, black, gay, military chaplain. Well, anyways, you got the point. The man is schizophrenic. I just saw him last week. He runs around in four different places. And I just, from this book, got, but he's very, very faithful, very trying to live out his faith, trying to be honest. He's denying his sexuality, but he's starting to be harder and harder to do that. And I thought, well, there's another text in Acts 8. It's called The Conversion of the Ethiopian Eunuch, where Philip is called by the Spirit, Acts 8, 26 through 39, is called by the Spirit to go and go to this place. Where is it? All right, I'll just read it. Then an angel of the Lord said to Philip, get up and go toward the south to the road that goes down from Jerusalem to Gaza. So he got up and went. Now there was an Ethiopian eunuch, a court official of Candace, the queen of the Ethiopians, in charge of her entire treasury. He'd come to Jerusalem to worship and was returning home. Seated in his chariot, he was reading the prophet Isaiah. Okay, well, just what happens was he doesn't understand Isaiah, and then Philip explains to him, and he wants to get baptized right there. And then he gets baptized, and he goes away. And Philip goes away. And this Piazza says that it was the practice in those days for eunuchs to be men to be castrated to serve.